It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
When widow Frances Lacey was murdered in July 1960 on Mackinac Island, only a few meager clues were found by police, and the case soon turned cold. But more than 60 years later, will those same clues finally solve the mystery? On July 24, 1960, the quaint charm and serenity of Mackinac, nestled between Michigan's upper and lower peninsulas, was shattered by Lacey's brutal death. Despite a massive manhunt and thousands of pages of police reports, her killer was never caught. Now, in Grim Paradise, true crime author Rod Sadler of Killing Women delves into the secrets of one of Michigan's most perplexing murder cases, offering an in-depth and suspenseful account of the long-standing mystery. He poses the question, could advanced DNA technology lead to the identity of the Mackinac Island murderer, as it did recently in the case of the Golden State Killer? Find out in Grim Paradise, the cold case search for the Mackinac Island killer, with my special guest, retired police officer, journalist, and author, Rod Sadler. Welcome to the program, and thank you once again for this interview, Rod Sadler.
Dan, thank you. It is always a pleasure to be on your podcast. And I'm excited for this new book titled Grim Paradise. I think that your audience would certainly enjoy reading it. It's an interesting case. So thank you for having me here.
It certainly is. And thank you so much. It's always great to have you back as a guest and to interview you. And congratulations on this new book, Grim Paradise. It is a very fascinating case. Let's get right to the genesis of this book. And you do mention right in the very beginning a little bit about this book and what you derive from it, but also a little bit about Mackinac Island, its proximity to the mainland, and its history.
Mackinac Island is really considered Michigan's crown jewel as far as vacation destinations. It's a small island that sits in Lake Huron in the Straits of Mackinac. It's about 5 miles from the coast of our upper peninsula and maybe 8 miles from the coast of our lower peninsula. It is home to the world famous Grand Hotel. If you've ever seen the Grand Hotel, you'll know why it's called the Grand Hotel. It's absolutely gorgeous. But this particular vacation destination has been there for well over 100 years. It's known mostly because there are no vehicles allowed on the island. In 1898, town council or the village council outlawed the horseless carriage.
Wow.
And of course, there are fire vehicles and an ambulance and a police vehicle and some public service vehicles. Beyond that, transportation around the island is by foot or by horse and carriage or by bicycle. And that's what makes it so charming. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place. It's got geologic outcroppings. It's got all sorts of touristy things in town to do. Great restaurants. Fort Mackinac is on the island. You can tour that. It's just a perfect vacation destination. And violent crime on Mackinac Island is virtually unheard of, really. And so that's the setting for this murder, this particular murder in 1960 of a Dearborn widow.
You talk about this place as a choice vacation destination eventually, but even at the very beginning. But part of that is this Grand Hotel. Tell us about this Grand Hotel and its origins.
Well, the Grand Hotel was built in the 1800s. It is known for having the longest porch in the world, which I believe it's over 600 feet long. It's a five-story hotel, very opulent. You can see it for miles coming across the Straits of Mackinac as you're approaching the island. It's very upscale. There's been a couple movies that have been filmed there, the most recent being Somewhere in Time with Christopher Reeve and Jane Seymour. It's visited by people from all around the world every year, and it's a sight to behold. It's absolutely beautiful.
Now, let's introduce this main character, Frances Lacey, her daughter Kay. She's married. This is her third marriage to a person named Ford Lacey. Tell us a little bit about the background of Frances Lacey before we talk about where she is, her and her family, July 22nd, 1960.
Sure. Frances Lacey was a widow in 1960. She had been married actually twice before in the 1930s and had divorced. Those marriages didn't last very long, but she had remarried a man named Ford Lacey. And Ford passed away in 1957. And so it had been about 3 years since his death when this particular event occurred. And Frances was really a very well-liked, personable person, but she was hard to get to know. She kind of stayed to herself, yet she was very friendly in the same sense to people. She had two kids, a son and a daughter in their 20s, early 20s, and she came from a large family down in the Nashville, Michigan, Hastings, Michigan area is where she grew up. And she originally was going to nursing school and had dropped out of that and started her family. And when this particular, I hate to term it as an event, when her murder occurred, it had been 3 years since her husband's death, and the trip to Mackinac Island with her daughter and son-in-law and his sister, she was so looking forward to, because she hadn't really done anything in the past 3 years for herself. And so for this short vacation, she was really looking forward to it.
Yes, you're right that she had struggled with depression and she took medication for that depression. And it looked like she was much better after this 3 year interval after her husband had died and she had cared for him till his death. And so on July 22nd, as you write that Frances, 1960, Frances set off on her trip to Mackinac Island with a small group, and they needed to take a ferry for this 8 mile trip to the Mackinac Island. Tell us who was with Frances and people that were in the family group, and also where they were, their destination on the island.
Well, their destination was an area on the island called British Landing. It's around on the northwest side of the island. Mackinac Island is only about 8 miles in circumference. So it's a very small island. And you can literally walk anywhere on that island. And so the group that was heading out with Frances was her daughter, Kay, and Kay's husband, Wesley. And then they also had Wesley's sister, Mary, with them. And they set off on a Friday night. They got up there early Saturday morning. They were only staying the weekend. And they went to a restaurant because the ferries, the passenger ferries, weren't running until 8 o'clock. So at 8 o'clock, they boarded the passenger ferry and they got over to the island. Now, Wesley's mother was already on the island and had rented a cabin at British Landing, and they had planned on everybody staying there. Well, Mrs. Lacey decided that she didn't want to put anyone out and she told them that she was going to stay at a hotel. And so she stopped at the first hotel, was literally at the end of the pier, and they weren't sure they were going to have a room. They wouldn't know until like 11 o'clock, and she didn't want to wait. So she took a brochure and for that particular hotel, and she put it in her purse. And then she walked across the street to the Murray Hotel, and they had a room available. And she paid, in 1960, she paid $5 and some cents for one night stay.
Right.
And she told Kay that, you know, after a day of sightseeing, she told her that evening, hey, I'll walk out to British Landing tomorrow morning and meet all of you.
So the next day, around 11 a.m., you say that they had expected her, also her sister had encouraged her, Kay, to not walk the distance and to take a carriage instead, because they thought it was like an hour and a half walk. So tell us about their concern and what happens when they make a call inquiring at the hotel.
Sure. What happened was Mrs. Lacey, police theorized that she had breakfast at the Murray Hotel based on some forensic evidence that was discovered. And after her breakfast at the Murray Hotel, she began walking down Main Street westbound. She walked for, it's not a big, long street at all. You can probably walk it in 10 or 15 minutes, if that. So she got to the end of Main Street and continued on around the west side of the island on a boardwalk, which was in place back in 1960. And she was going to be at the British Landing at about 11 o'clock. That's when they were expecting her. So at 11 o'clock, she doesn't show up, and the family begins to get concerned. They wait until 1 o'clock. She still hasn't shown up. And at that point, they decide, hey, let's notify the police. Wesley's half-brother was also there with his mother, a young man by the name of Marvin. And Marvin called the Murray Hotel right away at 11 when she didn't show up. And they said that she had already checked out. And so he left. He left British Landing on a bike and planned on probably finding Francis along the roadway on the west end of the island. But he did not. He was not able to locate her. And so they contacted the Michigan State Police. The Michigan State Police had a trooper assigned to the island during the summer. There was actually three of them assigned in different shifts. But at that time, there was one trooper on the island, and he rode a bike out to British Landing. And his first thought was, hey, Mrs. Lacey, she's probably lost. She's on a trail here somewhere. She's probably lost. But his first concern was, hey, let's make sure she didn't leave the island. So he called the Mackinac City Police. Mackinac City is at the tip of Michigan's Lower Peninsula. It's where the ferries run out of. And they checked and made sure that the vehicle that she had come in with Wesley and Kay was still there. He also had the local police, the Mackinac Island Police, check her hotel room. And they actually found a six-pack of Carling Black Label beer under the bed. But she was not there. They checked with the front desk. The front desk said she had left her luggage there. They found a key on the front desk that to her room, so they assumed that she left her luggage there and was probably going to come back for it before she left the island. That was standard procedure. People that were going to spend the day on the island, you know, rather than tote their luggage around with them all day, they leave it at the hotel and they pick it up later. So Her luggage was still at the Murray Hotel. And so they searched all day into the evening and up until 11 o'clock at night. And by that time, the trooper was certain something was amiss, and he had to contact his supervisor. So he made a phone call over to his supervisor, who was in St. Ignace, just 5 miles across the water to the mainland. And because it was so late, he said, hey, we'll be out tomorrow with a contingent of men and we'll search the island again. And so that's how this all got started.
Now, let's talk about that search, because they soon realized that it's unlikely that anybody could get lost on this series of trails, because it's all of the trails lead to somewhere accessible, which is maybe 100 yards away. So explain how they proceed with this search, combination of law enforcement and volunteers.
The island, again, is only 8 miles in circumference, and it is interlaced with horse trails, walking trails. They're just everywhere. And you're literally, like you said, probably within 100 yards of another trail. So it's very, very unlikely for anyone to get lost there. The search party on Monday morning consisted of, probably a dozen police officers, 65 volunteers, including some Boy Scouts and the Coast Guard. And they searched all day, and there was absolutely no sign of Mrs. Lacey at all. And then the theory became that maybe she had fallen into the water, or if she was suffering from depression, they couldn't rule out the possibility that she might have harmed herself. So they were looking at all different avenues of, or all different explanations for why she might be missing.
We should talk about the exhaustive investigation, really all of the directions that the police looked at simultaneously, including the Grand Hotel employees, chambermaids, and employees. Tell us a little bit about some of the directions that the police looked into that might be leading to a good suspect before we talk about the emergence of Paul Strands.
Well, once it was decided that, hey, there's something amiss here and we can't find her, officers started arriving from around the state to help in the search. They looked immediately at employees at different hotels, including the Grand Hotel, employees that suddenly quit, maybe on the morning that she came up missing. They looked at seasonal employees because Mackinac Island has a huge transient population in the summer of employees that work at the hotels and the souvenir shops and take care of the horses and things like that. This was during the Chicago to Mackinac Yacht Race, which is an annual event. It coincides within a week of the Port Huron to Mackinac Yacht Race. And so the island is literally flooded with tourists during those two particular weekends. It is during those two weekends, Mackinac Island is considered the yachting capital of the world. And it was on the weekend of the Chicago to Mackinac race that Mrs. Lacey came up missing. So in addition to the tourists and the seasonal employees and the regular employees and the island natives and the people on the boats, the police literally were overwhelmed. There was just so many people coming and going from that island.
One of the detectives that's involved in this murder investigation has a sort of a famous person connected with Hollywood somewhat, and that's Detective Anthony Perotto. And he is the person that is really very high on Paul Strands as a suspect.
He is. Paul Strands was a local transient resident, if you will. Every summer he came to the island and to work, and all he would do is odd jobs on the island. That's how he survived. He was from Indiana, and he was a little different. And as the investigation began to take shape, he was interviewed by Detective Sprato, and Detective Sprato was certain that he was involved somehow, but he couldn't put his finger on it. And so he said, hey, can we search your room? You know, if you're innocent, can we look in your room? And Strands said, yeah. So he took him over to the hotel. They searched his room. And Strands had some very odd things. He had a newspaper article about women protecting themselves. He had some drawings of some women that he had done. His suit coat was damp. And when they asked him about it, he said he got caught in the rain on Saturday and it hadn't dried out yet. They thought they had some blood spots on one of his shirts. It turned out that was just paint. But he just wasn't all there, according to the police reports. And they didn't have enough to hold him at that point. But Sprato made some mental notes about Strands. In other words, he said, we'll revisit Strands again. Maybe this is the guy that's responsible for Mrs. Lacey's disappearance. So they don't have enough to hold Strands. Anthony Sprato is pretty certain that he's involved in Mrs. Lacey's disappearance somehow. And so they release him from questioning. He was never arrested at that point. But as the investigation goes on, Sprotto gets a tip, a very valuable tip that leads, sadly, to the discovery of Mrs. Lacey's body. And that tip, if I can get into that, came about from a couple on the island who weren't supposed to be there. And by that, I mean they were having an affair. Nobody was supposed to know they were there. And on Sunday morning, the day that Mrs. Lacey came up missing, they arrived on the island at about 9:30. And they rented a bike, because that's the only transportation, and they started some sightseeing. And they rode around the west end of the island. And as they neared an area where there's a large gate that's flanked by two cobblestone pillars, they noticed purse laying along the side of the road. And so they stopped and picked it up. And inside was the identification of a woman named Frances Lacey. Now, understand that she hasn't been reported missing. This is on Sunday morning. And it's about 11 a.m. And as they stop, they hear some lumbering around in the brush on the inside of the roadway. On the outside of the roadway is Lake Huron, because it's a coastal roadway. And they hear this lumbering around, and they don't pay any attention to it. They think it's a large animal. And they see this purse. They see the identification of a woman named Frances Lacey. And so they find a brochure for the hotel that's at the end of the pier that she had sucked into her purse. And they said, well, we'll go back to the hotel and we'll find her and we'll give her purse to her. Well, they go back there, and Mrs. Lacey didn't stay at that hotel, if you remember correctly. Right. So the hotel says, no, we don't have anybody here by that name. And so they see that Mrs. Lacey's from Dearborn and they're from Detroit. So they said, we'll just take it back to Detroit with us and we'll track her down there and give it to her rather than try to find her on the island. So at the end of the day, they leave the island. Jump ahead 4 days. It's now made national news that Dearborn widow is missing on Mackinac Island, and her face is all over the newspapers and the TV. And they see it and they recognize the name. Hey, we've got this lady's purse. So they call the state police, and I'm giving you kind of the abridged version here.
Yes.
They call the state police, and the state police go back to the location where they found the purse, and that's where they begin to zero in their search for Mrs. Lacey. And sadly, that's when they find her body. She'd been there for 4 days. And the theory is, and it's probably correct, the lumbering around, the large animal they thought they heard, they probably had just interrupted the murder of Frances Lacey. That was probably the suspect getting away.
Wow. You write that they first find a denture in the pavement crushed, or a piece of denture crushed in pavement, before they find her body. Tell us the condition that they find her body, and obviously they can find out more information with the autopsy.
Oh, sure. When they started their search, they did find a smashed, like a dental plate, in the roadway, almost as if it had been run over, probably by a carriage. That did turn out to be Mrs. Lacey's dental plate. When they found her body, well, the first officer, they got on the inside of the gate, and he noticed an old overturned boat, and he went up to that and looked under it, and he found a plastic, like a shopping bag, and had one shoe in it, a woman's dress shoe, and there was a woman's dress shoe laying next to the bag. So obviously someone had concealed those there. And as he looked a little bit further into the brush, understand that this small cliff is covered with cedar trees and rocks and brush. And he notices a tree down with, it looks like some branches are propped up against it. And as he looks closer, he sees human hair. And he discovers Mrs. Lacey's body. She is laying face down. One of her arms is twisted up behind her back. Her clothing is pulled up to her shoulders. She has quite a bit of advanced decomposition because it's the hot summer. Her body's been out there for 4 days. So there's some decomposition going on. And as they turn her over, they discover that she has been strangled with her own panties.
There is also forensic evidence gathered. There are hairs, pubic and head hair gathered as well, isn't there?
Yes. The police located some hairs on her body that did not belong to her. Her hair was black and with some graying in it. She was only 49 years old. And they did take some of her own hair off of her clothing, but they also discovered some light brown to blonde colored hair. I think there was 5 or 6 different hairs that were recovered, not only at the scene, but during her autopsy. And those were crucial in the investigation. That was, of course, this was before the advent of DNA. So that was the forensic evidence that the police had, was these hairs. And those were sent to down to the crime lab in Lansing. Interestingly enough, the crime lab in Lansing was part of the Michigan Department of Public Health and not a part of the Michigan State Police. So while some of the evidence was taken to the state police post, some of the other evidence, the forensic evidence, was taken to the Michigan Department of Public Health to be analyzed.
You write that the family, William Lacey and Regina Cook, the mother-in-law of Frances Lacey, heard on the news and notified William, and Kay and Wesley Sutter were notified by the Michigan State Police.
They were. When Frances's body was found, two things happened. One of the troopers was assigned to go find Kay and Wesley and let them know that a body had been found. They believed that it was probably Frances. As that news circulated quite fast, it got on the media before the entire family could be notified. And that's how Mrs. Lacey's sister-in-law heard about it first. Sister-in-law's mother had heard it and then let William know, her brother. He was down in Detroit. So it was just a very tragic situation.
You write that Detective Spratto, now more than ever, wanted to interview Paul Strantz once again. And in that, he wanted to question him. They actually arrested him and brought him to Mackinac Island Police Department in their city hall. And Strantz gave police permission to search his room. Now, you speak of the media. You say local residents are shocked to learn that Paul Strantz was the number one suspect in this murder. And that's according to the media, isn't it?
It is. And not only to the media, I was lucky enough to actually interview some people that were on the island at the time of the murder, and they remember it. And I talked to this one elderly lady, and I said, what did you guys think when Paul Strantz was arrested? And she said, I was just a kid, but my mother was absolutely appalled because he had been in their house just days before doing odd jobs, fixing windows and stuff, because that's what he did. He used the old cliche from an old Harry Chapin song, job man. That's what Paul Strantz was. He did odd jobs around the island. And so a lot of the residents on the island were taken aback by his arrest. That didn't last long though, because Paul Strantz was released almost as quickly as he was arrested. They realized they just didn't have the evidence to hold him.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from these messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, we still have to get back to the condition that the coroner finds Frances Lacey's body and some of the things that are discovered, such as a semen and what that indicates. Tell us a little bit about the condition and what they find. And again, what they find in terms of strangulation, manual and assisted.
They did find during the autopsy, they noticed, in addition to the ligature that was around her neck, they discovered small bruising around her throat, and it was at fingertip intervals is how it's described in the autopsy report. What that told the pathologist was that whoever had killed her had tried to strangle her first with his bare hands, hence the bruising at fingertip intervals, and then used her own panties to create a ligature and strangle her to finish the job, if you will. They did recover the hairs off the body, and in Mrs. Lacey's stomach, they found, and this is how they determined that she likely had breakfast at the Murray Hotel. She had cantaloupe, pancakes, bacon, and coffee in her stomach. And so as part of the investigation, the investigators went and they searched all the restaurants on the island to see who served cantaloupe. And there were only two or three, if I recall correctly. And one of those was the Murray Hotel. And so they showed a picture to the waitress, and she said, well, she looks familiar. She said there was a woman that came down here with glasses and at about 8:30, but we didn't have gas in the stove yet, so they had a gas stove. And so they told her she'd have to come back. So she came back at about 9 o'clock, and there was a woman that had pancakes and bacon and cantaloupe and coffee. And so police do theorize that that, in fact, is where she had her breakfast. And the reason that that's important is because they were able to determine what time she finished that breakfast and likely started walking out to British Landing.
Now, you write that fear blankets the Mackinac Island, especially when they realize there is no good suspect and the police are stymied. Now, you have a litany, basically, of police doing their job. They are reaching out to the public and they are looking for tips. And they have to follow up on those tips. They're also doing follow-up investigations in terms of any connection to any suspect, now referring to people at other crimes and other cases. And you mentioned the Starved Rock murders in Illinois. So not to go down this rabbit hole of other information, but there's a reason why police officers, Michigan State Police, are looking at the Starved Rock murders in Illinois for a connection with the Francis Lacey murder.
Absolutely. There was actually, they did that in several instances in this particular investigation. The Starved Rock murders occurred in March. So it would have been 3 or 4 months prior to Mrs. Lacey's murder. It occurred in Starved Rock State Park in Illinois, where three socialite women were found bludgeoned to death. And without going down that rabbit hole, police theorized, hey, it's another murder in a state park in another state close to Michigan. There's a chance that it might be related to this particular case. And so they looked into the Starved Rock murders, albeit briefly. They also looked at killing in Minnesota that turned out to be like a contract hit. An attorney had paid some guys to murder his wife. It was the Thompson murder. And a couple of the people in that particular murder had ties to Michigan. One of them, in fact, was living in Lansing, Michigan. And his mother, he was actually from, I think it was Alden, Michigan, which is just very close to the bridge, to the Mackinac Bridge, which means it's very close to Mackinac Island. So there was that connection. They also looked at a serial killer. I hate to use the term famous serial killer, but a very well-known serial killer by the name of Hugh Byron Morris, who went on a murder spree from the West Coast to the East Coast and actually traveled through Michigan. And so they were looking not only at locals and transient population and employees on the island, but they were looking nationwide for a connection to this murder, too.
You also have a series of people that were either heard bragging about the murder, had said some interesting, almost incriminating statements about the murder, including the panties in strangulation a couple times. What I found interesting was, according to the police report, the police weren't certain that that information wasn't released via some media source. So I thought that was very interesting. They couldn't rule out, I don't think they could really assess those statements so well, since they weren't certain about the information that was imparted to media one way or another.
Absolutely. And they had two or three instances where people made the statement, oh, anybody could kill woman with her, anybody could strangle a woman with her panties. Or there was another guy that said, oh yeah, I killed her. I watched her eyes roll back in her head when I choked her with her maiden form panties. Even Paul Strantz, who showed up several years later, again on the island, a woman supposedly heard him say that he had killed her and he wouldn't have done it if she hadn't have screamed. Or so they had all these different statements. And then when they confronted these people, other than Paul Strantz, who was a little different, you know, they all said, oh, you know, I said that, you know, just to kid around with my friends. There was another guy down in Detroit that got arrested for domestic abuse or something like that. And he had made the statement he had killed Frances Lacey. And so they went and interviewed him. And he said, oh, he said, no, I didn't kill her. He said, I'm down on my luck. And I thought if I said something like that, I might get some attention. So, you know, why people would do that, I have no idea. But there was a whole list of people that did.
It was also a reliance by the Michigan State Police to administer polygraphs and then rule out suspects based on a favorable polygraph test as well, wasn't it?
Yes. Here's the trouble with polygraph tests. Now, understand that I was a police officer for 30 years and we used them. But in today's world, if you understand, I don't profess to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a criminal profiler by any means. But if you read the research, a serial killer, for instance, has the ability to compensate in the way that he answers questions. And because of that, is able to pass a polygraph examination. And so nowadays, if there's a good murder suspect, sometimes they won't even polygraph that person just because a psychopath is able to compensate in his answers and pass that test. And so a polygraph isn't allowed as evidence in Michigan anyway. It's another tool in the investigation to point you in the right direction. But they did. They polygraphed a lot of people in this case, and some of those people were cleared. Paul Strantz, they couldn't tell one way or the other because of his emotional state. So while they did clear him on the day of the murder by checking his alibi, when they gave him a polygraph a couple years later, they couldn't tell one way or the other if he was responsible.
Police also had to investigate people that had worked at the Grand Hotel and other hotels that had suddenly left the island right after or soon after Lacey murder, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There was a guy that worked at the Grand Hotel who quit. Oh, gosh. Might have been the night Mrs. Lacey came up missing or the following morning. And everybody thought that he was a suspect. He showed up at a hotel in Detroit. And when he disappeared, basically, nobody had seen him for weeks. They searched his room, the hotel staff, and they found his coat, and in his coat was a baggage tag from Mackinac Island. Well, they knew about the murder on the island, so they called the police. Well, the baggage tag matched a bag that was found on the docks up on the island. And so the police seized that, and they began to search for this guy, thinking that, hey, you know, he could be a suspect here because he quit right after Mrs. Lacey came up missing. And he was kind of a cantankerous person, didn't get along with a lot of people, drank a lot. And so they were following up on leads on him pretty hard. Harold Asp was his name. And they actually found Harold. The Indiana State Police found him. Well, I say found him. He heard that the police wanted to talk to him. He heard it in the media. And so he called the Indiana State Police and said, hey, do you guys want to talk to me, or the Michigan State Police wants to talk to me? And he made himself available to them. So they went and they interviewed him. And while his answers were very vague, they did ask if he would submit hair samples, which he did. And they took him back. He actually offered to go back to Mackinac Island to clear his name. And so they flew him back there. Three detectives and him flew back to Mackinac Island from Indiana. And he was able to clear his name. They were absolutely certain that he was not involved in the murder.
Well, now by December 8th, there's a new lead. Ionia County Sheriff Officer arrested a person named Cleon Brown for a break and enter, and he was sentenced to 3 to 5 year sentence. Tell us about Cleon Brown and police interest in him.
Cleon Brown was a lone criminal. He worked alone, and he went on a breaking and entering spree from Michigan to Florida and about every state in between. And when he was finally arrested, he was from the mid-Michigan area up around the city of Ionia. And when he was finally arrested, they sat down and they interviewed him, you know, to find out where he had been, see what crimes he was involved in, because he was singing like a bird. And he said that he had been on Mackinac Island. And this was just like 2 or 3 months. He was arrested 2 or 3 months after the murder of Mrs. Lacey. It was in November he was arrested. So they're taking this statement from him, and he says that he had been on Mackinac Island. Well, the officer that was interviewing him knew about the murder, and so he contacted the investigators up on the island, and they said re-interview him and pin him down on a date about being on Mackinac Island or see what you can find out. So they re-interview him, and he says, "Oh, no, I didn't say Mackinac Island. I might have said Fox Island," which incidentally is in Lake Michigan, not Lake Huron. But he said, I was on Fox Island. I didn't say Mackinac Island." And so they gave him a polygraph and he passed it. But on the same along those same lines, they asked him to submit hair samples, which he did. And the laboratory scientists that did the analysis, the hairs that were taken from Mrs. Lacey's body, he compared those with the hairs from Cleon Brown, and he could not eliminate Cleon Brown as a suspect because there were just too many characteristics that were the same.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from these messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, how do police proceed? Because, again, there are tips coming in, but meanwhile, there is increased pressure. You write in this book that the tourist industry, it was hit hard by the news of this, and it was almost non-existent at that time after in the new year of 1961.
Well, understand that in the winter, without the tourist population, you have about 600 residents on the island. And nobody on the island knew if the killer was a worker. They didn't know if it was a tourist, and they didn't know if the killer was one of their own. And that was very upsetting to them. Everybody was in fear. People that used to walk halfway around the island to their houses from downtown now were taking carriages. Everybody was in fear because nobody knew who the killer was, or if he was a local. And so as the investigation went on, you understand that they bring in, let's say, 25 troopers and detectives from around the state to work this case because it's really a high-profile case. Mackinac Island in the tourist industry is huge. And so they bring in all these troopers and all these detectives. And as tips begin to fade and information comes in slower and slower, crime doesn't take a holiday around the state. And so these troopers and detectives that were temporarily assigned to the island are starting to get sent back to their home posts, if you will. And basically, the investigation is now relegated to 2 or 3 detectives from the St. Ignace post. And that's it. That's what they had to work with. And as this went on, fewer and fewer tips came in.
You're talking by even 1964 that the case was at a virtual standstill, and yet they were still getting anonymous tips that they had to rule out and eliminate suspects, didn't they?
Yes. Occasionally they would get a tip. When Paul Strantz came back into the picture, that was 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years after the murder, and they re-interviewed him and tried giving him a polygraph, and they would get an occasional, there was a letter from a lady that thought a guy that was arrested in Chicago that was a tree trimmer might have been the same tree trimmer that she knew up in Sheboygan at the time of the Mackinac Island murder, and he could have been involved. And some of these tips were a little far-fetched, but they had nothing else to go on. And so they are obligated to follow up on every tip. They're trying to find a killer. And it just, there was a point where just all the tips just stopped and there was nothing more to work with.
Michigan State Police had assistance and assurances from the FBI that they would help in any way. They utilized criminal profiling in 2007 and then again in 2008, Robin Sexton and then David Minzy. Tell us what they did learn from this criminal profiling initiative.
The Detective Sexton knew that there really wasn't much to go on. I'm certain that he reviewed the entire police report, as I have, and figured that probably there was two things that could help in this investigation that may help. And one was to release to the media and to the public the fact that Mrs. Lacey's watch was missing and had been missing since the murder. That was never made public at all. And so he released not only a description of the watch, but the serial number too, maybe in hopes that someone would find in grandma's old jewel box or grandpa's old jewel box a similar watch that they could match the serial number to. That did not pan out. By the mid-2000s, actually, you know, back in the late 90s, 80s, criminal profiling had started. And so Detective Sexton had not only the FBI offer a profile of the killer, but also a profiler with the Michigan State Police. And their profiles were strikingly similar. Basically, they said that the killer was likely 18 to 19 years old, that she was not, Mrs. Lacey would not have been in fear of him. She had no reason to suspect that he was suspicious because she's on Mackinac Island, you know, Nothing happens on Mackinac Island. And it was a very rapid, they described it as a blitz style attack, that he had to be strong enough to pick her up and carry her body up behind the gate because it was not dragged up there. They offered some insight into what his mental state was, given how her clothing was arranged or disarranged, and the fact that her watch was missing, which is often a key element to a serial killer. And that is, they take a memento to remember and relive the experience that they have just committed. And that's why oftentimes you'll find a serial killer takes that memento. If you followed the news at all lately, there's a reinterest in the BTK killer. They're looking for mementos that he took that he has now said that he buried on his property. And they've actually found some. And that's a key element oftentimes to a serial killer. He'll take that little prize. And it was the same way with Don Miller in my last book. He took some mementos from his victims. So I think that the watch was probably that memento that the killer took. And sometimes they'll take that and they'll relive the experience. Sometimes they'll take it and they'll give it to someone that they care for.
Sure.
And that person never has a clue where it came from. So it's an interesting situation when that happens.
Absolutely. You write in The Grim Paradise that there's a Sergeant Rule, and she looks at person named, speaking of serial killers, Nolan Ray George. But especially because his crimes involve rape and strangulation with the victim's own panties. Now, she also checks that you write that she checks that there are several assaults, strangulation murders involving the victim's own undergarments, but she's interested in him and as a suspect and goes and interviews him in prison. Let's talk about what you call a new person of interest and why. Who is this person and why he became a person of interest?
Well, it's an odd situation about how I came across his name as a person of interest. But in a nutshell, this particular person was a serial killer. He's passed away now. He was in prison for a cold case murder that he was convicted of that occurred in 1973, and he was actually convicted of that murder in 2001. That case had been cold for that long. Prior to that, came across his name, and someone had suggested that I write a book about him. And I thought, well, it might be interesting, but there was already a book written about him. And so I thought, well, I'll look at this 1973 murder that he was convicted of. Well, it turns out that his first arrest was in 1961, just 1 year after the Lacey homicide. He was 20 at that time, which would have put him 18 or 19 years old at the time of the Lacey homicide. He also, in digging into his background, a year before the Lacey homicide, there was a newspaper article when he got married where he tells the reporter that his college plans after he's married is to go to the Michigan Institute of Mining and Technology, which is in Houghton Hancock, Michigan. It's Michigan Tech nowadays. That's in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. So he clearly has understanding of Michigan's northern territories, if you will. He has light brown to blonde colored hair. In between the murder that he was eventually convicted of, there was another murder of a 16-year-old girl in the mid-Michigan area. And the method of operation is basically identical to the Francis Lacey homicide. He was, at the time of the first arrest in 1961, he actually did not go to Michigan Tech or the Institute of Mining and Technology. By that time, he was going to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Well, in the police reports, and I will say that all of the police reports were redacted, so there were no names for me to follow up with. But many of the people that were interviewed were University of Michigan students who were working on the island for the summer. And so, well, I can't say with any degree of certainty that he was involved in the Lacey homicide. I certainly think that there's enough information that he should be looked at as a person of interest. And that's where we're at with that. He died last year in prison in August of last year. So if that evidence can be located, then at least they have a new name to begin with. Does it sound like, yeah, maybe I'm stretching it? No, I don't think I am. I think that this is how you solve a cold case. You go back over the evidence, you look at what you have, and you look at what you maybe have overlooked. And it may be as simple as the color of a person's hair. You know, it could be anything. They've had 63 years to solve it, and they haven't done it yet. So why not look at this guy? And I think that Cleon Brown could be another legitimate person of interest, too.
What we didn't mention, that there was a couple that emerged that said that they were on Lakeshore Road, the route that Francis Lacey was going to use and likely did go down towards the British Landing. This couple had seen a man that they described as medium height, medium build, a blonde hair or lighter hair, and about 18 years old, which seemed to fit with your person of interest at the end. And also, I believe, Cleon as well, no?
Absolutely. Cleon would have been the same age. He would have been about 20. The person that I name at the end of the book, he would have been 18 or 19 at the time. And that particular couple, this is not the couple that found the purse. There was another couple,
yes,
who had started off on a carriage ride. And so when police interviewed them, they asked him, hey, what did you see along Lakeshore Road? Because they were out there between like 9:30 and 11. And they said, we only saw two things on Lakeshore Road. We saw a couple on a tandem bike, which is the people that found the purse. And we saw a man, 18 to 19 years old, walking along. They give a description, and he's walking with his shirt undone, open shirt. And so that fits, you know, it fits not only with the age of Mr. Brown and the person that I name at the end of the book, but it fits with the criminal profiles done by the state police and the FBI too. So I think that those people on the bike, while they just missed the murder of Francis Lacey, the other couple in the carriage ride probably saw the killer that morning.
You include in this book too that this person of interest, 1 year after Francis Lacey murder, was arrested for the kidnapping and rape of a blind co-ed.
That was his, I should have mentioned that when I started in on this. His first arrest, in fact, was in 1961, and it was a year, literally a July of 61. It was exactly a year after the Lacey homicide. And he had kidnapped a blind woman in Ann Arbor, where he was going to college, and raped her and committed an armed robbery and then stole her car. And so he went to prison for that. And he served, I think, 7 or 9 years of that sentence before he was released.
Yeah, it's a very interesting case as well, from the two murders that were dismissed over discrepancies over search warrants. But you described the details of those crimes that he was charged for, brutal crimes and a brutal serial killer, no doubt.
Oh, absolutely. The murder of the 16-year-old that they suspect him of was in the early 80s. There was a 16-year-old girl up in Carson City, Michigan, that was kidnapped, and they found her body about 2 weeks later, just west of Cadillac, Michigan, another tourist town in northern Michigan. And she had been strangled to the point that the ligature was so tight that it had ripped through her skin and rested against her spine. It was that severe. And someone had written down a license number. Well, it turns out they searched his van and they obtained a bunch of trace evidence from inside the van. When he was at his preliminary examination for that murder, the search warrant was brought up, and the fact that the deputy's statement, the detective's statement in the search warrant, did not match the statements from some witnesses. And so the judge threw it out. He said it was an absolute blatant error, and he threw that search warrant out and the case collapsed. And so to this day, her murder remains unsolved, although they suspect without any doubt that he was responsible for her death.
And as is Francis Lacey's case as well.
Absolutely. Still unsolved. Same method of operation, strangulation. I'm certain that there are things involved in certain details in the murder of that 16-year-old that I don't know, that I have not been made privy to, if you will. But I suspect that there are details in there that would likely match up with the Lacey homicide.
Certainly. It's an amazing chronicle of the exhaustive investigation that the Michigan State Police undertook to try to find the killer of Francis Lacey. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about your new book, Grim Paradise: A Cold Case Search for the Mackinac Island Killer. For those that might want to take a look at this information more so, can you tell us where they might take a look?
Absolutely. You can actually order signed copies of Grim Paradise, The Cold Case Search for the Mackinac Island Killer, on my website, which is www.rodsadler.com. Or you can find copies of Grim Paradise on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, at a great tourist destination here in Michigan, in Clare, Michigan, called Cops and Donuts. Yes, it's a bakery owned by cops, and they carry my books there. And several of the smaller bookstores around northern Michigan I've reached out to, including the Island Bookstore on Mackinac Island. So
wow.
Any place you can buy books, they should be able to order it for you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Rod Sadler. Grim Paradise, The Cold Case Search for the Mackinac Island Killer. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening and good night.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.